All right. Lawyer talk off the record on the air. We're going to talk about Murtaugh, Lethal Weapon, Danny Glover, Mel Gibson. I'm getting too old for this. I am getting too old for this. Now we're going to talk about the Roger Murtaugh. That's the character in Lethal Weapon. Troy's too young to know that.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of you that are my age or above, you probably know that movie.
I'm working on it.
Did you ever even see Lethal? I think there's another one coming out too, by the way.
I think I probably have seen it, but it was a long time ago.
There's a 1, 2, 3, and I think there's going to be a 4. Joe Pesci is in the second one as like the mob accountant.
Mm-hmm.
They fuck you at the drive-thru. They always fuck you. It's that. You ever see that scene?
I believe.
Right. Anyway.
Don't worry. I'll get to it. I'll get to it.
All right. So look, but in all seriousness, the Murtaugh case has been on Netflix. It's been on all sorts of documentaries. It's been on the news. I mean, it's just like one of these scandal sheet type murder cases.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole family, by the way, I don't know if you followed some of this, but his son was in this boat accident, drunk, killed a teenage girl. I mean, just horrific stories around this family. And then I think that's the same son the father allegedly murdered. And then it comes from a family law firm and
that knows how to party, I guess.
They know how to do it up. Living beyond their means, with the prosecutor would say. Mm-hmm. Got himself in all sorts of financial hot water, spending money he didn't have, robbing his clients' fees out of the trust accounts at the law firm. He allegedly did that with his housekeeper, had a PI case, and stole the money. I mean, just horrific stuff.
And then the state's narrative on how Murtaugh got all the attention off this financial trouble.
We'll get to that. Okay. So then, you know, it turns out one night he goes out to his barn or something at the party house, and there, lo and behold, his wife and son have both been murdered. And it's looking awful fishy to the police, who think, who would do this? And quickly, Murtaugh gets the, he quickly is in the hot seat. They charge him and try him and convict him for murder. Mm-hmm. In this sensational jury trial for murder. I mean, it's a Dateline case. It's been on Dateline. It's been on Netflix. It's been on all sorts of movies about it. But yesterday, because we're bringing you yesterday's news 3 days later.
It was yesterday. The decision was yesterday.
Right. So the decision is yesterday. So we're bringing you yesterday's news today.
Mm-hmm.
And the Court of Appeals reverses the case.
Yeah.
Meaning.
Well, The Virginia Supreme Court.
Or the Virginia Supreme, not Virginia. This is in South Carolina.
Was it South Carolina?
Yeah,
you're right. Supreme Court of South Carolina,
The South Carolina Supreme Court reverses the case. So here's what happened. Murtaugh is convicted at trial. He files a notice of appeal and goes directly to what's called a court of appeals, which is, we call this a direct appeal. Look, if I screw up your South Carolina procedure, forgive me. I'm in Ohio. I'm just talking general here. It's not legal advice. We're just talking. And the Court of Appeals in South Carolina says, look, whatever mistakes you're alleging, we don't care. No big deal. We are going to affirm, or rather uphold, the conviction. So you're still convicted of murder. You lose your appeal. Sorry. Well, that's not good enough. And Murtaugh's legal team says, no, we're going to ask the South Carolina Supreme Court to look at it. They eventually do look at it. And the South Carolina Supreme Court reverses. Really interesting issue that I think is... first of all, I agree.
Yeah, I mean, based on...
I totally agree. I mean, this is... So what happens? Well, Mr. Young Troy, give us the facts.
Yeah, so Steve gave the general procedural ladder. However, there was actually a different procedural ladder that happened here. What happened was they filed a notice for the appeal and instead asked the Court of Appeals to stay it because they were going to have a motion for new trial. So instead of going right there, they first did a motion for new trial based on...
Misconduct.
Yeah,
jury misconduct.
Yes. And so they go out, have jurors, they give the jurors letters instead of numbers. So they have juror Z and juror X and all these jurors fill out affidavits and explain what court staff, a Mr. Hill, I believe.
All right. So when you're using days and dems, the jury that convicts Murtaugh is, so there's probably 12 of them and maybe some alternates. The defense team, and we should back up even more. If my client gets convicted, often we would go talk to the jurors afterwards. Sometimes they run out the back door and they hate me and they don't ever want to see me again, or they're exhausted from deliberating. They just leave. A lot of times though, we get to talk to them, We say, look, what happened? What's up? What's going on? You know, and I like to get tips. Hey, where did I go wrong? Did I offend you? And a lot of times I hear, look, I'm hiring you if I ever get in trouble, but your client was guilty. I mean, all right, fine. At least you're honest. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times we'll get some feedback, and I presume that's what happens here. The lawyers start getting some feedback from the jurors about what happened in the deliberation room. And this is enough. This is a big enough case, probably enough money behind it, a high enough profile case where that probably got the ire of the lawyers to get an investigator involved and start poking around. And the investigators find out
that Hill is making comments to the jurors.
Hill being a...
It's some court...
Like a clerk of courts or some court employee.
Yeah.
Not associated directly with the prosecutor, not associated directly with the defense, but somebody who works at the court is named Hill, and she is feeding information to the jurors during during the trial.
Mm-hmm. And saying stuff like, to watch him closely, like immediately before he testified, including to look at his actions and look at his movements, which, you know, that could just be, that's instructions, if anything, a judge should be giving, like, at the end. And then this shouldn't take, and then Juror Z testified that when the jury began deliberations, Hill told the jury, this shouldn't take us long. And in addition to referencing Hill's statements, Juror Z aversions affidavit, I had questions about Mr. Murdaugh's guilt, but voted guilty because I felt pressured by the other jurors. Like,
all right, well, let's unpack this here a little bit. Hill, being a court employee, is feeding information to the... Now, we should probably... People would probably ask, how in the heck does this happen? Well, in the context of a jury trial, like, and it's not... Most people don't ever get to see the nuts and bolts of this. We're in a courtroom. The jury is seated over here. The judge is up on the bench. The witnesses are over here. And then during breaks, the jury is ushered out by court staff. And the jury goes and hangs out in its own deliberation room. And a lot of those rooms are like repurposed conference rooms. Some of them are dedicated jury deliberation rooms in newer courthouses. Some of them have, a lot of them have bathrooms and little sinks and fridges with drinks and such. And then while the jury is waiting on the lawyers to do stuff like argue about issues or discuss jury instructions or whatever it is, there's just a lot of sitting around time.
Yeah.
And the jury's waiting in the back in this little room. And the judge will tell them, look, don't talk about the case until we tell you to start deliberating. You know, we don't want you to reach any conclusions, yada, yada, yada. So what do they talk about? I don't know. They probably talk about the weather. I'm sure they never violate those rules. I'm sure they never talk about the case. I'm sure nothing nefarious ever goes on in the jury deliberation room unless you can prove it. In this case, it seems that there is proof.
Yeah.
And that involves an outside source, this Hill individual.
Yeah. And
who maybe, I think it's a she, but maybe her job is just to order the pizzas for lunch or to make sure their needs are met, make sure that if they need a phone or, you know, whatever it would be, this is the person that is tasked, I'm surmising, with helping the jury.
Yeah. And she makes some other comments like, don't be fooled by defense's evidence and watch Murdaugh closely. Like,
yeah, if I'm defending Murdaugh, that would be upsetting to me.
Yeah.
So, and look, I think it's important to really discuss, like, when we do this, when we work on appeals and we work on cases or we work on even trials, I always try to, like, everybody knows on the face of it, yeah, this is bad, this shouldn't happen. But I think it's really important to dig into it a little bit more. And, you know, why is it bad?
I think this is bad because I feel like everybody should have their own independent opinion on the case. That's what the whole point of these jurors and deliberating is. And now, like, before deliberation starts, they're getting prodded with, if you're on the fence, get off of it, because come on, we all see what's going on here.
Yeah, but even more, like, more than that, you've got a situation. I think we should, what I always try to do when I analyze these issues is put myself in the position of the person in this situation, the jury. And you show up to court, and most people, in my experience, have not. It's usually their first time in jury duty, or if they've had jury duty before, it's years ago in some different place, and they don't know what's going on. It's new. And think about walking into a new place, walking into high school for the first time, walking into a government building for the first time, and you're sort of like, where do I go? What do I do? You're not really comfortable, and people who aren't comfortable, this is human nature, right? We're looking for a leader. We're looking for somebody to tell us what to do. Hey, I got this thing. Where do I go? Oh, don't worry, Mr. Henriksen. Come with me. I'm going to show you right where you check in. You're going to do this. You're going to do that. You're going to do that. So immediately, I am the person you can trust.
Yeah.
And what if, in this situation, the person the jurors can trust is telling them not to trust the defendant?
Mm-hmm.
This is a person I would be arguing to the court that from the perspective of the jurors, this is the person who has the answers. And I think the jurors would also, maybe something else, another thought is coming to me here, which is like the jurors only get some of it. They always feel like they're deprived of information, and they are.
Yeah.
They don't get the whole story. But I think the jurors, from a juror's perspective, it's not a stretch to think all the lawyers know what's really going on, but they just can't tell us because there's rules.
Mm.
But now we got this person who's in on it with us.
Yeah.
And she's telling us what's going on. And if she thinks that he's guilty, then he must be, because everybody knows. I mean, these guys, the lawyers all know what's happening. And now this person's telling us. That's why this is so dangerous.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Yeah. The psychology of this is really dangerous. So back to the court decision. I mean, so what Troy is saying is I make mistakes every now and then. But I screwed up.
That's a very unique procedural process.
So what happens is you've got immediately a whiff of this jury misconduct issue, and that can be raised. That has to be raised, I'm presuming, under South Carolina law on something called a motion for a new trial. So there's a guilty verdict already inked, and before a notice of appeal, it goes up on direct appeal, the lawyers intervene and file something back with the trial judge and that says, look, we have some irregularity in this process. We've got juror misconduct. We want a new trial. We demand it now. In other words, we don't want to wait to go all the way up to the Court of Appeals. And why? Because in the Court of Appeals, we raise issues that are already on the record. And this issue is coming to the lawyers outside the record of trial. They have to make a record. They have to establish a record. They have to say, look, judge, there's stuff that's not in the trial court transcript that we need to talk to you about. And it has to do with these jurors getting information from Hill. Here's affidavits. Here's testimony. Here's witnesses.
I'm just now reading this. I guess Hill was very personal with these jurors. He gave one of them a
guy.
I don't know. I keep, like, they don't use a pronoun. I don't know if Hill's a guy.
You can't trust pronouns anymore anyway. So
you're right. But like, I can't tell if Hill's a guy or girl. I'm sorry. But Hill gave one of the jurors a ride home.
Right. So look at this. I wonder. Would you like to be a fly on the wall during that conversation?
What are you? We're just gonna remain silent the entire car ride. We're not gonna talk about the case whatsoever. Just stare forward.
Yeah, I mean, look, how does that happen? And if you're a lawyer, if I'm a lawyer in this case, and I hear tell that the court staff is driving jurors home, I would be like, "What is going on? I want an immediate inquiry." Anyway, the lawyers present this new information back initially to the trial court, the judge, and they have a hearing on it. We were working on a case in our building.
Yeah.
That this kind of stuff happened. There was some weird stuff going on in the jury deliberations.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyers they gather up affidavits, they gather up information, and they present that information to the judge for the first instance of a decision. In other words, that judge has to decide it, and that judge says sorry.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I still can't imagine this. So if I'm sitting, you're sitting on this case and you hear tell that one of your staff is telling the jurors what to say or what to think about Murdaugh's testimony, the defendant's testimony in a murder case. Watch him carefully. And they're not saying that. Watch him carefully for a tell that he's telling the truth. They're going to say, watch him carefully for a tell that he's a liar.
Yeah.
And not only that, I know he's a liar because I work for the courts. I got the inside scoop. I got all the information, and you can trust me.
So Hill stood in the doorway at the deliberation room in front of all the jurors. They're going to say things that will try to confuse you. Don't let them confuse you or convince you or throw you off.
And look, I get it. These are accusations. So I don't know if any of this was proved, but it's proved case.
I mean, there was affidavits, which I mean, we should probably talk about the Allende rule also.
All right. There's a rule out there called Allende, Allende. Allende means outside the matter or outside sources, I think, is the Latin. And Allende, this is all fancy talk, and we're going to break it down. So I like to speak both languages. I can speak law geek, and I can speak normal. Really what they're saying, really what the Allende rule is. And, you know, I didn't, Ohio's, This comes up in Ohio a lot. Anyway, the Aleander rule says, look, you can't impeach or you can't go after a jury verdict with only information from the jurors.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do it. In other words, just because you, a juror, Troy's on a jury and he tells me, look, I felt pressured. All right. There's a rule that says that alone is not enough to overturn a jury verdict. It's not, you have to come up with something else outside the purview of what you, am I correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Outside the purview of what you perceive. So the Aleander rule, it protects the sanctity of a jury verdict.
Mm-hmm. We didn't have it. Every single post-conviction defense attorney would be calling up these jurors.
That's right.
Like prodding them and then bringing in affidavits every single time. Like,
yeah. So I didn't want to vote this way, but I got pressured. Whatever. Mm. And incidentally, did you see a juror in the OJ case recently came forward?
I did not
see
this.
So here we go. We're going to call this a sidetrack. We're going to go off the beaten path here. A juror in the OJ case came forward and said, basically, look, we thought he was guilty, but we found him not guilty as punishment for the Rodney King debacle in LA. We just felt that that's how it should be. So we're getting our justice that way. We're getting a measure of justice because of Rodney King by acquitting OJ. Anyway, if it would have gone the other way, that they convicted OJ because of something in the opposite, what would the defense have been doing? They would have been screaming up and down.
Yeah.
But, newsflash. They thought OJ was guilty. OJ was guilty.
I think OJ thought he was guilty.
I don't know. Look, maybe he was innocent. Who knows? Maybe it was a Colombian necktie, as F. Lee Bailey famously said. But anyway, we back at it. We've got jurors basically saying after the fact, look, we've got this person outside the jury sanctity telling us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
How to view the credibility of the witnesses and not to get fooled by the defense. If you're a trial judge and you hear this, we have to also talk about the psychology too. We're all human, folks. I mean, look, anybody who thinks that you're electing an official and somehow he decloaks himself from human frailty just because he puts on a badge or puts on a robe or ascends to the position of Congress or president or whatever. We're human. We're built of, our system is built of humans and with all the imperfections and frailties.
Yeah.
And if you're a judge, if you're in the system, you're a prosecutor, the last thing on the planet you want to do is monkey around with crap like this. I mean, you just got done with a big pain in the ass jury trial with cameras and news reporters and, you know, all this nonsense.
You had five attorney generals on there.
Five attorneys general. Anyway,
it's like a school of fish, you know, there's some plural term for it. We'll figure it out.
Attorneys general.
Yeah.
Counsel for the attorney. Anyway, you got all these people there and you got it done. It's sort of like you had a term paper, you had a big project doing law school. So Troy, being a studious young man, we come in to do this podcast in the mornings and he's sitting over here at the command center and is putting the final touches on this like 20-page paper that he started the night before. He hadn't been to bed.
I got here at like 9 p.m. Right. I was here until like 6 in the morning.
To do the show, must go on.
Yeah.
At any rate, it would be like hitting delete and losing that and thinking, I got to do that again?
Yeah.
You're going to avoid that at all costs. And this judge avoided that at all costs. I mean, he's got, if this evidence were true, or if this evidence were in front of me as a judge, I'm looking at trying to look at this like, after the fact, and I'll put myself in his shoes. And I think you get to maybe lead to two different answers. After the fact, I'm looking at this, I have nothing to do with, or even in the middle of it, I had nothing to do with this trial and I hear a court staff was telling the jurors, essentially, don't believe the defense. They're going to try to trick you. Watch Murdaugh carefully because when he talks, he lies. Whatever it is, I'm driving jurors home and getting on their team and saying, look, you got to go through it, but come on.
Mm-hmm.
I would be, you're looking at this, is like, how do you not immediately vacate the verdict, get rid of the verdict and do a new trial? And, you know, I'm sure we're going to get lots of comments like, look, he's guilty, fry him, whatever. Fine.
Mm-hmm.
But you've heard me argue this. If you live in this county, if you live in that state, if you live in this country and you operate within our system, you want to be able to put your head on the pillow at night thinking, all right, we're going to be tough on crime, but we're not going to convict people in unfair trials.
Yeah.
Because the next time, heaven forbid, might be you.
What bugs me a lot on this is I imagine there was overwhelming evidence that he did kill
it. It wasn't overwhelming. It
wasn't overwhelming. But
I mean, they had a defense. I mean, look, there was some circumstantial. I mean, maybe there was some direct. I don't know the evidence. I watched some of the. It shows you what I do at night. I get these things on TV and I try to watch it. All right. It's in the background. I don't know. So I don't know the case. We should probably break it down one of these days.
But they didn't need to do this. And maybe the state probably actually had no idea this would even go on. It was probably just literally Hill.
I have read nothing, nor would I think that the attorneys general had anything to do with this. And if they did, then shame on them. I mean, that would be like the story of the century.
Yeah.
That's basically jury fixing and jury tampering, and that'd be a felony. But no, I don't think so. I think this is just a busybody for the court.
Yeah.
Who didn't like Murdaugh.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe didn't like Murdaugh's lawyers. I mean, who knows the motive? That's the problem with this stuff.
Yeah. I think Hill also had no credibility at this hearing because they put him up and they're like, did you give a juror a ride home? And he's like, no, the juror saying he gave a ride home. And not only that, the bailiff was also in the car.
Oh yeah. So
and it's like, dude, why are you up here lying about this? At that point, if I'm the trial, also they didn't put the same trial judge. They brought in a separate one just for this hearing.
Okay, good. Right.
Which so, I think that's a good idea because, you know,
in Ohio, around here, you'd get the same trial judge.
Yeah. But if I'm sitting there and I hear two witnesses who have nothing to lose say that you gave a ride, and then I hear that you now gave a ride, and now you're saying you made none of these statements.
Well, giving a ride home is one thing in and of itself. So in law, in these kind of things, in the legal system, we use a term. You know what it is?
No.
The appearance of impropriety. So if something has the appearance of impropriety, it tends to cast some doubt on the system in general. So what we try to avoid as lawyers, as professionals, as judges, as, you know, whatever your position is in the system, we want to avoid the appearance of impropriety, meaning we don't want to look like we are engaged in some sort of biased behavior. Driving a juror home creates the appearance of impropriety, meaning it looks funky.
Yeah.
It just looks bad. You know, on the one hand, you could say, look, this is the court doing, it's a small town, small county. We're just doing, you know, Mr. Jones a favor, getting him a ride home. Well, look, use the taxpayer money to call him an Uber. But you can't engage in that kind of stuff. Like if the judge is having lunch with a juror, or like, would that be okay? No.
Oh.
If the trial lawyers were having lunch with jurors, would that be okay? No.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when I walk into a courthouse, day one of trial, meaning we're going to go pick the jury, I start the moment I wake up because I don't know who I'm going to encounter between then and the courtroom. And it may well be a juror. So if you're one of these lawyers, and there's stories of this, like road rage on the way in because you're stressed or whatever, maybe you're just an asshole, I don't know. And you know, you're giving this guy the bird and you're fighting with him. And it turns out he's on your jury panel. Like you don't do that. Now I don't operate that way anyway, so I don't have much to worry about. But you know, always presume that you are in the professional eye. So you don't give anybody the appearance that you're doing something wrong or something biased or something funky. So when we go in and we're getting in and out of the elevators and there's jurors around, I always tell the jurors when we do have a chance to talk to jurors in voir dire when we're picking them, and we get to say, look, guys, you know, I'm going to look like I'm a schmuck during this trial. Not in here, but out there, because I'm going to pass you in the hallway, inevitably, coming in and out of the bathroom, going in and out of the elevators, walking in and out of the court metal detectors, and I'm just going to act like I don't see you. And I'm not doing that because I don't like you. I'm sure you're a pleasant person to hang around with, and maybe we'd have coffee or even, I don't drink anymore, but maybe some beers in a different world. But in this world, I can't, because I don't want anybody to think that I'm trying to trick you, that I'm trying to influence you, that I'm trying to get you to like me just because, and then not vote on the evidence. So we don't want anybody to have the appearance of impropriety. So we just avoid it altogether. And the court staff, getting chummy with the jurors, I think certainly creates the appearance of impropriety.
Mm-hmm.
What's the judge say about it?
Judge about says about what?
Did they bring in a new judge?
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it says there was not. At the hearing, the judge just said that it wasn't prejudicial. didn't grant a new trial. That was it. That was at the trial level.
Yeah, what could be prejudicial about that? Don't believe the defense. I mean, look, so what the judge maybe is saying, and here's something that comes up. If I'm a judge and I want to bulletproof this, I would say, I listened to the testimony of the jurors, the testimony of Hill, the testimony of the bailiff, and all the other people that testified, and I didn't believe them. Or the judge would either have to say that, or the judge would have to say, look, even if all that's true, I don't believe it prejudiced the outcome of the trial.
Mm-hmm.
And this then, the judge denies it, and the defense says, now we're going to appeal to the direct appeal, the Court of Appeals. And the Court of Appeals agrees, I think. Or did it, the Court of Appeals, I think, does not reverse, but the South Carolina, one of two things. Look, why would we know? We're just a podcast talking about the case.
Also, when it's this soon, it's very easy to go back to the direct appeal and do all that. But because the decision just came out, this system is not like totally updated. They're still wonking it out. I'm trying to hop back and see, but there's also some states that like call their direct appeals like the Supreme Court.
Yes, New York does that. Anyway, look, the first Court of Appeals, I think, denies relief, agrees with the trial judge. And then the South Carolina Supreme Court says, look, guys, under no circumstances could this not be prejudicial. On its face, this is prejudicial. We can't have a life sentence for murder resting on the foundation of this.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really what they're saying.
Like, yeah, yeah.
You know, are you really putting your head down on your pillow at night in this county, in this state, in this country, in this system, saying, yeah, we're sure that this didn't impact the jury's verdict at all, even though a lot of jurors said it did. And even though on its face, if you're sitting at the murder table being accused of murder and you're not guilty, and if you think that doesn't happen, you're wrong. It does happen. And if you're sitting, and I'm not making any comments about whether Murdaugh is guilty or not guilty, because here's the point. We don't know. You don't know for sure. And if you want to have a trial and you want to prove it, then do it fair. And if you're sitting there thinking that you wouldn't be bothered by that if you or your son or your daughter or your husband or your wife or anybody else you love is sitting there facing a life sentence and you've got some guy at court basically saying, don't believe the defense, everything they say is BS. You would be incensed. You would say that's not fair. And the reason you would say it's not fair is because it isn't fair. It isn't right. And if nothing else, it creates the appearance of impropriety, and the stink of it just is too much for the South Carolina Supreme Court to endure. And I agree with them 100%.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, round two. Now, there's another issue that came up in this trial.
Oh, yeah.
And this has to do with, so it turns out Murdaugh is not just a criminal, he's a crook. Allegedly.
Well, no, I mean, he got convicted for that one.
He was convicted in federal court, I believe, of a bunch of financial crimes for stealing money from his clients, his law firm, or other places. So, and on that, I think he's doing 40 years.
Clerical error. That's what it was.
This guy clerically stole 40, or stole a few $100,000. Anyway, he's doing a pretty good chunk of time in federal court. And one of the other issues that came up, and we're not going to spend much time on this, we'll do it separately, has to do with whether the prosecutor could tell the jury about those other thefts in Murdaugh's murder case. In other words, not only is Troy a murderer, but guess what? He stole a bunch of money from all his clients. He's a no good, rotten murderer and a thief.
Steve did a very short summary there. The state managed to say all that in a smooth 12 and a half hours the jury.
12 and a half hours of testimony on how much money Murdaugh stole, and their stated the ostensive purpose for this. In other words, what they told the judge they were presenting this evidence to show is that Murdaugh was killed his wife and his son in order to distract and gain sympathy so he could maybe win the theft cases in federal court or some version of that. A stretch at best, I would argue, and I'm sure the defense did argue that. The trial judge let that evidence in, and I think the Court of Appeals and the South Carolina Supreme Court had stuff to say about it, but they didn't have to decide that issue because they were sending it back on this other jury problem. I think they did sort of say, maybe a stretch, reevaluate, trial court.
Yeah, I think 40 years for a financial crime is kind of hard. I mean, he only did take $10 million. From these people.
I mean, look, I've had lots of thefts like that. They're going on right now, PPP thefts. I mean, it's like people steal money like that all the time. And you know, if somebody's worth, if, yeah, yeah. It, look, it's a lot. And usually in federal court, if you buy yourself, no pun intended, a 40-year sentence, you have done something not to mitigate this, or you have not mitigated the case. You have not taken responsibility. You have gone to trial. I don't know what happened with all that, but if you fight a case like that in federal court, the U.S. federal sentencing guidelines will get you to those,
yeah,
those numbers very fast. And that's why, you know, like it or not, plea bargaining happens a lot in those kind of cases because the exposure is huge. Now, they may have hated Murdaugh enough where they said, we don't care.
Yeah.
They being the U.S. attorneys. But anyway, that's a topic for another day. Let us know what you think about this Murdaugh thing, because I say some of this stuff tongue in cheek, but I am curious how people feel about this. Because on the one hand, you could say, look, the jurors convicted him fair and square, and they wouldn't have listened to this Hill or bailiff or anybody else. Is that enough on its own to say, look, the appearance of that is just funky, stinky, and murky enough that we don't want a conviction resting on that pedestal? Or you could say, look, no matter what, even if it didn't influence the jurors, should we reverse it? Or should we just say, look, let's just evaluate the evidence anyway, and if he was guilty, he's guilty. I got my thoughts on it. I've already told you I would send this back for a new trial every day, all day long, mm-hmm. in every system across the board.
Yeah, I think Hill needs to look for a new job.
Hill is being charged, by the way, I think, with probably some sort of obstruction of justice, or at least they're contemplating charges.
Oh, wow.
It should be. I mean, that's a crime.
Yeah.
Should be. If not jury tampering, then something else. But whatever crime they have down there that would fit this mold.
Hill, if you need an attorney.
Right. An attorney, I'll be happy to fly down and get admitted to South. Of course, I probably burn myself now with this podcast. Damn.
Oh. Steve won. It's Rebecca Hill.
Rebecca Hill. There you go.
It's a female.
There you go. I didn't just surmise it from the facts, by the way, folks. This has nothing to do with this person's gender and drawing stereotypical conclusions. I read that somewhere yesterday when I was reviewing this. All right. Lawyer Talk off the record, on the air till now. By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.